would be a good way to get Tony really, give him something he can really sink his teeth into. And I thought, well, if something came between him and Lucky, that might be a jumping off point. And I thought, well, what's a good thing to do? What if Lucky found out that Luke had raped Laura? And then we can clean that up. But how would he find that out? And then I thought, well, what if he had to take part in a rape victim's recovery, so he saw what that was, what that crime did to women. And it all just sort of fell into place from there.
She made television history when she was named the first black head writer of a daytime drama. On today's episode of the Daytime Confidential podcast, Michelle Valjean joins us as that soap opera, ABC Daytime's General Hospital, celebrates its 50th anniversary. Michelle's current soap home, CBS Daytime's The Bold and the Beautiful, also recently celebrated a birthday, turning 26 on March 20th. Michelle, welcome.
Hi, Jamie. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is our pleasure to have you with us today. Well, first off, happy, happy birthday to both GH and The Bold and the Beautiful. What does it mean to you to be part of two soaps celebrating such unheard-of broadcast television milestones?
It's a little overwhelming, actually, especially the General Hospital 50th, because I spent so much of my life and my career there. I was there for 19 years, minus 7 months that I took off, but... And then to have transitioned to this show, which is just, I'm so in love with the show. I mean, I love the show. I love the people. Brad Bell is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I'm reunited with Patrick Mulcahy, who is, you know, my writing god and dear, dear friend. And, you know, I've been very lucky, you know, in my journey.
Nice. Nice to hear that.
Michelle, you've been posting memories of your time at GH on Facebook and Twitter. Has it been fun to relive your times in Port Charles with so many soap fans on social media sites?
It's been a blast. I'm sort of like, you know, I don't want to seem like I'm tooting my own horn too much, but it's such a good excuse to go back and revisit, you know, what for me, the 90s especially were like the golden years for me on General Hospital when Wendy was the executive producer. We did so many fabulous stories, and I had such an incredible experience as a writer, and just to go back and pull some of my favorite moments has been just so much fun, and the response to it has been encouraging, and it's like I've been doing it more and more and more, but I'm going to stop after April 1st.
No, don't stop. Don't
keep
stop.
Keep going.
Keep it
going.
For the whole month.
Yeah. Now, Michelle, you received much critical acclaim for revisiting Luke and Laura's rape while penning the story of Elizabeth Weber's sexual assault on GH. What does it mean for you to be forever associated with such a powerful storytelling?
Well, I'm very proud of that storyline. I've been very open about the fact that I've had that experience. I was raped as a 12-year-old girl, and It was very gratifying for me to be able to tell the story of a young girl going through the process of recovery and finding love again. And at the same time, actually, if you want to know the whole genesis of that rape story, I really wanted to do something for Tony Geary, because at that point in time, he was kind of bumping up against other people's stories and he didn't really have anything. And he hadn't won an Emmy since 1983. And I thought, what would be a good way to get Tony really, give him something he can really sink his teeth into? And I thought, well, if something came between him and Lucky, that might be a jumping off point. And I thought, well, what's a good thing to do? What if Lucky found out that Luke had raped Laura? And then we can clean that up. But how would he find that out? And then I thought, well, what if he had to take part in a rape victim's recovery, so he saw what that was, what that crime did to women. And it all just sort of fell into place from there.
Wow.
Now, Gloria Monty, during the time of the original rape, after Luke and Laura took off as a popular couple, she tried to rechristen it as a seduction. Having gone through a rape in your own life, was it important to you to write that or correct that misconception or that trying to gloss over the history of it?
It was. I mean, I was watching the show back then, and I saw the rape, and I knew it was a rape, and, you know, okay, it was a seduction because they really took off as a couple, but, you know, the opportunity to address it and call it what it was, yeah, that was real important to me.
During your time on General Hospital, you were instrumental in crafting stories for the Ward Clan and have been open about how much the late Rosalind Cash resembled your own mother. Her ultimate passing left a huge hole in the General Hospital canvas. Do you feel the wards would have remained viable had she lived?
Yes. I think she was the heart of that family, and once the heart stopped beating, the family just sort of, you know, there was, I don't want to say there was no interest in writing for them, because Justice was still around for quite a while after that, but the heart was gone. Mm-hmm. And the thing, you know, the thing about Mary May and my mother, it wasn't so much that she reminded me of my mother per se, but when she auditioned, I was in the booth, and a bunch of really fabulous black actresses read for that role. And they were all spectacular, and they were all very moving. But when Rosalind read, I started sobbing. I had to go home. I started sobbing uncontrollably because there was something about her that reminded me of my mother. Well, I got to know Rosalind. She was nothing like my mother, and that all went away. But I always thought, that was so weird. What was that about? She had the same kind of cancer and died from the same kind of cancer.
Wow.
So I think there was something in me that sensed that in her. Mm-hmm. And that's what got to me.
Well, Michelle, you talk about you know, sensing things and being a writer, and you know, it moving you. I read the book Writing Down the Bones, and do you feel that there is a spiritual component to writing, and you know, in terms of connecting with a character and giving birth to a story?
Absolutely, it's a gift. It's I'm a channel. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a gift that I don't understand, and that there was nothing to qualify me for being a daytime script writer. You know, I grew up in the music business mostly. I'm, like I said, I'm a vessel, I'm a channel. When I'm writing, the characters just start talking in my head, and I transcribe what they say, basically, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. It does, definitely.
Now, Michelle, you also tweeted fond memories of writing the Ryan Kevin mystery that saw John Lindstrom playing Trouble Twins. How much research did you do into the sometimes dysfunctional, relationships shared between twins in writing that story?
The scary thing was, I did no research whatsoever. John and I would talk about it. We would. I got to give credit to Claire Levine. She saw that John and I had a real creative spark together, because we would talk about, like, when we were doing the Ryan, crazy Ryan stuff. And then she decided to give him the twin, and she basically let us figure out who Kevin was. And I just wrote that stuff just, you know, from knowing what John was capable of doing. And I've always, like, liked reading about, like, crazy serial killers and, you know, like, deeply psychologically flawed people. And I think that just all sort of came up there. And I had this actor who could really do anything. And what was important to me about Ryan, though, was to make him funny. You know, he was crazier than batshit. But he was, oh, can I say that?
Yeah.
But there was always something funny about him, and basically what Ryan wanted was to be loved. He just wanted somebody to love him, because nobody ever had, and he had been abused by his mother, and Kevin had been showered with all the love and attention, and he just wanted to be loved. He didn't know how to go about doing it, though.
Yeah.
So you started killing up, folks. Now listen, John Lindstrom is back on GH along with everyone who ever appeared on the show, pretty much.
I know.
Have you been tuning in to see Mac and Felicia and Kevin and Lucy et al., you know, everyone that's back?
I have to admit, I did set my DVR to start watching that stuff, yes.
Yeah, it's really kicking into high gear. Like today's episode is pretty much all vets. So, yeah, it seems like it would be a treat for more so than I would say the '90s era. I mean, of course, you know, Luke, Laura, and Scotty started in the '80s, but there's a lot of attention being played for that whole Mac, Felicia, Kevin, Lucy era. But cool beans.
Before that, though, you know, I was a big General Hospital fan. I remember I was working for this management company in Beverly Hills, a music management company, and it was right next door to a Hamburger Hamlet. Uh-huh. And every day at 2 o'clock, I would go to the bar at the Hamburger Hamlet, and I'd order a lobster bisque and a Bloody Mary, and I would watch General Hospital. That was during the whole left-handed boy story.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I started in about 93 after another show you worked for that we'll talk about later. After I started watching GH. But now, you left GH in 2012 to take your current position on the staff of The Bold and the Beautiful. Now, you've remained steadfastly loyal to former head writer Bob Guza, of which I'm a fan of Guza's.
And so I know am I.
Jillian's a fan of Guza's, but he's one of the most polarizing head writers on Twitter and Facebook, and people blame him for everything, you know, from global warming to optics over GH. Tell us, and not to get you in trouble, but you've defended him on Twitter. Can you speak to that of why you've said you would have gone down with the ship with him? If you could elaborate or shed any light on that.
I've known Bob for a very long time. We were both scriptwriters on Santa Barbara. And so I worked with him during both of his times there on General Hospital. And I was there. I know the pressure he was under. I know the concerns sometimes very much at odds that he had to try to address. I know the dictates that he had to work under. And I know what happened. And I'm not saying Guza was perfect. He got tunnel visioned, and the canvas was not balanced. But there were decisions made, that he had to go along with. And people think they know everything, and they don't.
Well, you tell it like it is, Miss Michelle.
Let's talk a little bit about your current soap, Stomping Grounds. What's the biggest difference writing for B&B than writing at General Hospital?
B&B is a very hard show to write. B&B is a show that basically every story is a love story on some level. Even when people are in conflict, we have to keep in mind that this is family. You know, these are people who have been interacting for 25 years, and even if they're mad at each other, you have to play that history. What was hard for me was I didn't know the show. It was the first show I'd ever written that I didn't know when I joined it. And so that was really hard on top of the fact that I'm, you know, conflict queen. And, you know, I write the cat fights and all of that stuff. So I had to kind of, you know, temper my snark level and learn how to have people be nice to each other. As opposed to, you know, Carly going around town biting everybody's head off. Mm. So that part is hard. And also, we have a lot of freedom to shape our days. You know, we don't really get extensive outlines. We get notes, and you kind of have to, you know, you really have a hand in creating what happens in your, you know, how you shape your day. Not what happens in it, that comes in the notes, but how you shape that. There's a lot of freedom there, which is was pretty intimidating for a while until I, you know, I've been on the show now for almost a year and a half. So I know the characters now, and I know this. I've been a part of the storytelling for a while, so it's a little bit. And I know what Brad likes and doesn't like now. So it's gotten easier, but it was really hard. Whereas General Hospital, I've been on that show so long, I could, I mean, you know, almost write it in my sleep.
Now, at B&B, you reunited with Patrick Mulcahy, whom you previously wrote with on GH and on Jamie's beloved Santa Barbara.
Actually, Patrick was gone by the time I got there.
Oh, okay. Well, after working together for so long, do you two sort of have a rhythm down?
In our friendship or?
With writing.
In the writing process.
With the writing process.
You know, it's kind of a solitary endeavor. You know, we kind of write our scripts and turn them in, and then, you know, at once they're edited, you know, well, we get versions of each other's scripts. But there's not a lot of, you know, I'm doing this in my day and you're doing this in your day. You know what I mean? It doesn't really work like that.
Now, your current boss, Brad Bell, has to be one of the funniest guys in soaps. Does he bring that kind of energy to the writer's room?
Oh, I'm not in the writer's room. Michael Menis, Kay Alden, Patrick, and Brad are basically the head writing team, if you will. Brad is the sole head writer, but they consist the writers of the writer's room. They get on the phone every week and figure out how they're going to break the week and stuff. But he brings humor to everything, and he gives the best parties. The best parties. I mean, that party Saturday night was so much fun.
Well,
he knows how to work a press room, trust.
He does.
And he's just, you know, he comes from the soap opera dynasty, you know. He has, I'm not going to say he has no ego, because everybody has some ego, but the nicest guy in the world. And if you met him on the street, you would think he was just some ordinary guy.
Yeah, he's really charming. I remember the first time he was in the press room a few years ago, and I was so upset about something on Bold and the Beautiful. And I was like, I told Luke, I was like, after he talks, it's like anything you thought you were going to give me, like, I'm going to ask him this or that. And you were just like, okay, that was so funny. And you just like, what was I going to ask him? Like, now, Michelle, we mentioned we've been, you know, talking about it. We've been threading it all the way through, but you know, you and I already have talked about this. One day I wrote on Facebook how I used Sophia's speech in the final episode of Santa Barbara. I have to tell you the story. DC listeners already know this story because I think we did a podcast about the craziest things we'd ever done for soaps. Well, my church, I used to have to give short talks when I was a teenager, you know, and my grandmother would volunteer me and be like, well, it's youth day. Whose kid is going to speak? And my grandmother would always be like, my grandbaby can talk. And I was like, oh my God, I've given like four of these this year. So I procrastinated and did not write the speech. So I get up there in front of the congregation and I start off going, life is so very precious. And some older sister in the audience goes, yes, Lord. And so very, very tenuous. And if you live that life in any way on a lie, then ultimately you didn't deserve to have it at all. So I'm coming to you today saying that if you don't learn to love Jesus, that's where I edited. So basically, I plagiarized your Santa Barbara speech for my church, my Black Baptist church short.
That is hysterical.
I totally did Sophia's last speech to Cece on that atrium. I remember you wrote on my Facebook one day, you were like, I wrote that episode. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is such a full circle moment.
Is that the same episode? Is that the same episode where Cece gives some speech to her too?
Yes.
Oh,
and I recited it for Jillian.
Yes, yes, Lord, yes.
That's so beautifully summed up. Their relationship. What was working on what I consider to be the gold standard of soap opera?
I couldn't believe I landed there, because that was my favorite soap too, Santa Barbara. I thought it was brilliant and way, way ahead of its time. And I thought the writers on that show were the most incredible. You know, that's where I fell in love with Patrick's writing. You know, it was just like, who are these people? And I had only been in the business, you know, I only had logged in my 6 months on Generations before it got canceled. And then I got a call from my agent, who said that Santa Barbara, that Jerry Dobson wanted to meet with me. And I was like, me? Why would he want to meet with me? So I went over and talked to him, and God, they hired me. I was so terrified. I thought, I'm going to last a week. I'm going to turn in a script. They're going to say, you know what, let's just pay off this girl's trial deal. We made a big mistake here. But that didn't happen. And then the other thing that was crazy, I'd been on the show maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, and Bridget and Jerry had much, much, much vacation time. They were always, like, flitting off somewhere. And Bridget was the editor. And she called me one day, and she says, darling, I'm going to make you the editor for when I'm not around. And I was like, what? And she says, yes, it's very easy. She says, all you have to do is, if you like something, you keep it. If you don't like it, either take it out or change it. I was like, but I can't edit these writers. The first script I ever had to edit was a Bob Guza script. I was She says, you'll be fine. Don't worry about it. It's going to be great. And so she made me an editor, and there I was, you know, with these writers, and I had to, if I liked it, keep it, and if I didn't, change it or lose it.
Wow.
Very intimidating, very scary.
Oh, I bet. Trial by fire.
And actually, this is kind of a funny story. Guza was always late with his scripts, and Bridget never did anything with them. She just basically sent them through. So they're like almost literally standing on the floor begging for pages, right? And he finally turns it in, and frankly, I thought it was overwritten. So I start cutting here and cutting there and cutting there. And everybody at the studio was so shocked. It was like, wow, this is pretty different. And anyway, so a couple of days later, I get a call on my answering machine. It's Michelle, this is Bob Guza. You know, he has that voice. And I was thinking, oh, shit, you know, he's going to be so mad, you know. So I called him back, and he said, I wanted to thank you because you really saved me on that one because it was overwritten and I had gone too far. So I just wanted to thank you for your eye. And I was just, it was so validating, you know. And anyway, being on that show was just, it was just a dream. And the Dobsons were just the best couple. I always thought they were out of time, you know, that they would have fit in the 1940s Hollywood, mm-hmm. you know, with their sophistication and their wit and their great stories. And it was a lot of fun. It was really awful when they got fired again, mm-hmm. you know.
Definitely. Now, is it true I've always heard that they based Lionel and Augusta Lockridge on their own marriage?
I heard that too. I couldn't say that with any certainty, but I've heard that rumor too. And yeah, I mean, I could see it.
Wow.
Oh my God. Now, you also wrote for a groundbreaking multi-ethnic soap, Generations. Are you proud when you see shows like Scandal and Grey's Anatomy finally being able to tell colorblind stories?
Absolutely. And, you know, Generations got such a raw deal. The time slot sucked. You know, it came on smack in the middle of Young and the Restless. And and the support that should have been there wasn't there for it, you know. But it was to talk about a great first experience, because we were always living under the threat of cancellation. But we all really, really believed in this grand experiment that Sally had created, you know. And that gave us a real sense of family. And so when that show got canceled, it was literally like a death. We mourned that show and celebrated it. And, you know, to this day, I wish Prospect Park would do a reboot of Generations, because that's another show I think that was ahead of its time.
Oh, I loved Generations. You know, I posted everywhere on Facebook that epic smackdown of Doreen and Maya, when Doreen just grabbed up her gold lamé dress. Love it, love it, love it to bits. I'm like, you know, everybody talks about Carly and Sam brawling. I'm like, no, 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 no. That is epic beat down right there. That was my show. Loved it to bits. Yes, I sat and cried a little bit when they canceled it.
Hey,
team.
Luke, she's kind of acting like I act about Santa Barbara, about the adventures. So now I can meddle you.
Listen, Jillian's been on the podcast for how many years? And this is the first time I'm hearing
right,
this. This would not be the case for you.
Our listeners say, one of them left in the comments, we should do a drinking game every time Jamie references Santa Barbara and pointing out what's wrong with soap.
Well, I heard Jillian groaning as soon as you brought it up.
It's not another world. It's Santa Barbara. Like, he quotes CC's speech. Like, you know, he says something. It's you, baby. It's you or something. I'm like, I didn't even watch it, and I know this.
The problem I've run into and tried to educate about the majesty of Santa Barbara, unlike Another World, which is also my baby, there's tons of YouTube clips out there that I could show as examples of the greatness of Another World, but all the Santa Barbara clips are in Greek or French. I'm like, how do I show? Oh, Michelle, we could do this all day. But listen, before we go, I wanted to get your thoughts. You mentioned Prospect Park. We've lived through such precarious, you know, doom and gloom over the past 4 years or so in daytime. And now there seems to be a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. Your soap, The Bold and the Beautiful, is climbing. I think I saw that they had a four-year high in total viewers. Their numbers are steadily growing. GH's ratings have rebounded, and now we are having two canceled soaps returning in a new medium online. What are your thoughts on the current state of soaps, and do you think, this is a pie in the sky question, but do you think the day will come when a broadcast network will ever green light a new soap?
I don't know. You know, broadcast networks can be really short-sighted, and, you know, if ABC canceled those shows in the first place. I mean, soaps will never die. The nighttime is littered with soaps. All this Scandal is a soap. Grey's Anatomy is a soap. Revenge is a soap. They're all soaps. Anytime you follow a group of people over the arc of a season through their lives, you're looking at a soap. Right. You know, it's not a closed hour deal. It's a continuing dramatic arc, and that's a soap. And soap fans are always going to be there. People, you know, have been serialized listening to radio, to televisions, you know, since the beginning of time. So I'm happy that the four surviving soaps are doing really well. I'm happy that All My Children and One Life to Live are getting another chance. And I hope it works, because if it works, then maybe the networks might take a look and say, well, you know, these talk shows, these food shows, maybe not such a great idea.
Well, from your mouth to a development network executive's ears. Michelle, thank you so much for being here with us again. Congrats on GH, a show that you spent 20 years of your life at, reaching its 50th birthday, and also on The Bold and the Beautiful's 26th, and we will just keep watching and being entertained by your script. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun to talk to you guys.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.